Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. We have a fascinating program tonight. We have a few of the Oiskim B'Tzarchei Tzibur Be'amuna. We have Harav Rabaron Kotler, the CEO of Beis Medrash Gevaya. And we have Dr. Alan Kadish of Turo, who left a very prestigious job at Northwestern University. They lured him away to Turo. I don't think he knew what he was getting into. But on both of these, it could be said, Kol Oiskim B'Tzarchei Tzibur Be'amuna, Kadosh Baruch Hu, Yishalem Scharam. And we can certainly say on them, Kevavas Shamrem, Darshi Yechudcha Kevavas Shamrem. They play such an incredibly important part to our community. We will also have the tzaddik, the famous doctor, Dr. David Pelkowitz. And the topic will be life after Kollel. We all know it's a beautiful thing, but Parnasa after Kollel, what is the impact on these families' lives post-Kollel? Next week, we will have something that's never happened in the history of America before. We will have the Ravid of Eretz Yisrael of the Hedach Redis, Hagrava Goyin Ramayesh Shtarm. I've personally been learning his farm since I've maybe 10 years old, the Baal Mayadim Azmanim, Shuvas Van Haggis. He will give us some psak on the telephone. So that's certainly going to be a great honor. So, but before we begin, I'd like to talk about a little bit. I'd like to start about the tzaddikim of Klal Yisrael, and let me recount a personal story that happened to me. This is not ish mi pi ish, but this is actually a first-hand story. So I had to be in Mexico for a certain event, an important event, and I'm in Cancun, and it was Sunday morning. I'm there with my Rebbetzin, and I have a stomachache. So what do I assume? I assume it's the Mexican coffee. Who knows what they put? Maybe they put a tamale into the coffee or something. So it's during the day, and my stomach ache's getting worse and worse and worse. So first I drink a half a Pepto-Bismol, then I take some Tagamet. I go down to the drugstore, I clean them out. By like 6 o'clock at night, I said, you know, I better self-diagnose. So I go on YouTube, and I find a diagnosis, how to self-diagnose a stomach ache. If it hurts here, it means this, here, this. So I self-diagnose, and I says, if it hurts here, and this is where it hurts me, it says, congratulations, you have an appendicitis. So I quickly call up my doctor in New York, Dr. Wurzberger. I send him a video of it. He looks, he says, you know, you may have an appendicitis. You should get to a hospital. I said, a hospital in Mexico? I mean, did they use rusty knives over here? And then I Googled hospitals in Mexico, and I find a cartoon where it shows a doctor standing with a knife over somebody. And it says, and then his anesthesiologist is holding like a boulder over the guy's head. He said, be prepared for your anesthesiology. And I call back my doctor. I said, you know, I could get a plane out of here in the morning. He says, you know, if an appendicitis bursts, it could be very life-threatening. So what do you do when you need surgery in Mexico? What is it? What does the Yidla do? He does. He picks up the phone. He goes online. He finds the local concierge. Who's our local concierge all over the world? You call your local Chabad Shliach. So I look up on the internet. I see there's a Chabad Shliach. It says there's a Rabbi Mendy Druck. I call him up. I say, you know, Rabbi Druck, I'm stuck here in Mexico. I have to go for surgery, I think. Maybe. I hope not. And, you know, do they use clean knives here? Do the doctors want? What do I do? He says, look, there's only one hospital you should use. This is the name of the hospital. I'm going to jump into my car, grab a taxi. I'll meet you there in 20 minutes. Now, this is now 7:30 on a Sunday night. I said, you sure? He says, I'm sure. So I jump into my car, a taxi. Me and my wife, we go down to the hospital, take a nice little clinic over there. He meets me there. And who does he have next to him? Mauricio, a tzaddik, a young fellow who davens in his shul. He does have a shul in Cancun. And he says, this guy, not only does he speak Spanish fluently, which I don't, obviously, but he says he's actually friends. This is Chabad Network. He's friends with the owner of the hospital. Now, last week was a holiday weekend, by the way, in Mexico, like sort of Thanksgiving weekend now. So he says, you have quite a job ahead of you. You got to get a CAT scan. You got to get an MRI. You have to have ultrasound. And you have to get an anesthesiologist and a laparoscopic surgeon on a Sunday night and a holiday weekend. But with the owner of the hospital, in Chabad, 3:30 in the morning, and the Chabad Shliach stayed with me, right, told the surgery, and this fellow Mauricio stayed with me the entire time. People I had never met with or spoken to before, they arranged it. They took my appendix out, thank God. was, you know, top flight. They picked the right surgeon, the right anesthesiologist. So kudos to those tzaddikim. Wherever you go in the world, I say, pick up a phone. You're in trouble. The Ahavas Yisrael they have is extraordinary. So I was, by the way, chatting with this fellow, and I said, so what's it like being a shliach here in Cancun? Like, is it a lot of fun? Like, I don't know, maybe shots of tequila? He says, honestly, he says, you know, it's quite difficult. He says, for example, you know, Mexico's not New York or Oak Park, Michigan, where I grew up. He said, they, 2 weeks ago, they thought since I'm an American, I must be wealthy. They don't know that, you know, Chabad Shluchim typically barely have two nickels to scrub together. They pumped gas into his apartment, sleeping gas from under the door, and they put his entire family to sleep through this narcotic. They came in and they emptied out whatever they could. I can't imagine these Chabad Shluchim have too much. I don't think they took the picture of the Rebbe or the Tanya, but they took maybe, he said they took his computers, his cell phones. So it's not an easy life. But they do it with Mesiras Nefesh, and I say kudos to you. I say you are really the emissaries of Klal Yisrael in these far-flung places. You do it by Ahava, your Tzadikim. I give you, you know, whatever my bracha is worth, and it's not worth much. It's certainly a Berchas Het yet. But just it was a pleasure, and you're a blessing, and you're a Kiddush Hashem and a Chizik to all of Klal Yisrael. So all of you, wherever you're traveling, you have a concierge service all over the world. It's called the Shluchim of Chabad. And I want to talk about another event that happened this week that I think was just a very moving and a meaningful event. So everybody knows that 2 weeks ago, Rabbi Yaakov Litman and his son Nisanel were shot dead in a terrorist attack in Eretz Yisrael on Route 60. And it was a week before their daughter's wedding. I think they were going to the Shabbos Ufruf. And after the Shiva, they made the wedding, and it was last night in Eretz Yisrael. And the Kala invited all of Klal Yisrael to the wedding. And I understand people came from Australia, from Europe. They came from Asia, from Montreal, from the United States. It was an amazing wedding. And I have on the phone a very short clip of a conversation I had with a very young, amazing rabbi in Eretz Yisrael, also my son-in-law. His name is Rabbi Yala Goldwicht, the young Rabbi Goldwicht. And he was at the wedding. And he's going to describe very briefly what happened. Let's cut into the conversation.
Last night I had the chutzpah to go to Sarah and Aliyah's wedding. Everyone knows that her father and her brother got killed 2 weeks ago, and her wedding was postponed till after the Shiva. So first, just before even arriving to the wedding, there were thousands of people waiting outside to get it. She invited all of Am Yisrael to come to the wedding. And she actually rewrote an invitation. So the first invitation, like the rest of Am Yisrael has, on top it said, Odi Shama Biari, Huda Vachutat Yerushalayim. But the second invitation, the one after her Shiva, when she invited the rest of Am Yisrael, it said, Nisnari Na'afra Kumi, Livshi Big Day Safai Tuchami. And all of Am Yisrael came really to try to be Mr. Me'achas and the Kala. And there were thousands of people waiting outside just to get in. Took for people a few hours. Towards the end of the wedding, there were still thousands of people outside, so the Chasen Kala actually came out to this massive courtyard where there are thousands of people there, and they were able to dance with everyone. But I was zocheh to go inside, and as I came inside, so the song that they were singing, I think it's an Avraham Fried song, and the words to the song is, Ribono Shel Olam, Ani Yodea, I know, Shebeis HaMikdash HaShlishi, but the third Beis HaMikdash, Eno Bani Na'avanim, it's not built from stone. Elo Bani Nidmos, built from tears. In Komash Atzarech, Rakdima Achat, if you only need one tear, there's Akasha Kacha Shali, please take my tear. And it wasn't a dry cheek at the wedding at that time. Everyone was crying and dancing at the same time. Seeing her, like, davening, seeing her, when you were singing Anachnu Ma'aminim B'nei Ma'aminim, Vilanu Al Mili Shal Al Avinu Shvash Shemayim, also everyone's tears was flowing down their faces, and it was just it was a sight of emunah. It was mechazik everyone, and just the power that this young girl had. People flew from all over America, from all over Israel. There was a delegation from, I think, Montreal, Canada. There was 12 people that came from there because they heeded the call to come join her at the wedding. And every single person was there for 100%. The purpose was to be Sameach Chatan Kala. And everyone tried their best. And it was very bittersweet and it was very sad and it was very happy. But it's really also the message in this week's Parsha that Chinuch says, why do we not eat from the Gidda Nasheh? Like, what's the connection? So what? So the Sarah Shalisa hit Yaakov. Why don't we eat from the Gidda Nasheh? So the Sefer HaChinuch says that it's a reminder for Doros, for all the Jewish people to come, that even though we were injured, even though Yaakov was injured, he was still able to get up and continue. He was still able to, you know, take his family and build an unbelievable house. And that's what everyone felt last night. It was really the message of Am Yisrael, the message of Judaism, that throughout our history, we always hit the Kaf Yerech. We're always hit at the feet. People are always trying to trip us over. And all we do is we stand up and we continue. And it was an amazing chizuk for us, and it was an amazing chizuk for anyone who attended.
You're listening to us on WMCA 570 or WMCA.com or at the Nachum Segal Network at NachumSegal.com. If you have any questions, you can always email them to us at questions@headlinesbook.com. Additionally, you can listen to us at Nachum Segal at 11 a.m. on Monday morning or on WSNR, that's 620, on Wednesday night at 10 o'clock. We have on the phone with us Rabbi Aaron Kotler, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Beis Medrash Gevaya, which is the largest kohel in the world, perhaps the largest yeshiva in the world, and grandson of Rav HaGoyin Rabbi Aaron Kotler, great-grandson of Rabbi Zalman. It's an honor to have you with us. Welcome, Rabbi Aaron.
Hi, David. How are you? Good evening.
Rabbi Aaron, tell us about your grandfather's vision for kohel.
I think first and foremost, he saw Torah as the foundation for Klal Yisrael. And in his day and age, people of his milieu, of his environment, were abandoning Yiddishkeit in droves. And if you think of the world he grew up in, very famously told how in Minsk, he himself was drawn into the circle, potentially drawn into the circle of the Maskilim, and there were quite a number of other circles there. There were secular Zionists, there were communist Jews, and all types of movements, ideological movements that were attracting the young. And what he saw in his own life was that without Torah, none of these movements had a kiyum or could contribute to the continuity of Klal Yisrael. And it was something that he lived through, not as an abstract idea, not as a philosophy, so that he himself experienced, and it's also famously told how he and Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky were whisked out of Minsk by Reuven Grozovsky, who prevailed on them to go to yeshiva in Slobodka, if I'm not mistaken. So it was something he lived through, he had experienced, and he saw the effect of that. When he came to the United States, he saw a Jewish community that had built glorious shuls, beautiful hospitals, and Avoda and Chesed were the foundations of the Jewish people in the United States. You go to, for example, go to the city of Newark today, you'll see the nicest Baptist churches, which are today Black Baptist denominations and Protestant churches and all, and you'll see they all have beautiful Lucas and Mug and Dubbids on them, and there were great hospitals and all. And at that time, in the 40s and 50s, the prevailing view in the United States was that through Avoda, in a sense, shuls, community and chesed, that would ensure the continuity of the Jewish people. And to him, he looked at that and he said, without Torah as our foundation, it would not last. And he was against the tide in that regard, as in he was in other regards, but he was against the tide. He saw something and understood something that the others did not see.
So, Rabbi Aaron, tell us about the kohel movement that he founded in America and, you know, the burgeoning of the kohel, etc.
Interestingly enough, Rav Samshur Fall Hirsch writes of the movement in Germany. There was a time in Germany in the 1800s where religion became the province of the few. And the average Jew in Germany, as Rav Hirsch writes, considered that his religious obligations were fulfilled by the rabbi, through the rabbi. So the community had a rabbiner, and the rabbiner were the religious ones, and they were the observant ones, and they had a ceremonial role to maintain Judaism for all. In a similar vein, there is a notion that Torah belongs to a few, that it belongs to an elite, and it does not belong to the masses. My grandfather's view was the opposite. He felt that Torah was the Yerusha, was the inheritance of every single Jew. It doesn't belong to the rabbis. It doesn't belong to a handful. It belongs to everybody. And he viewed Torah, in a sense, as the great equalizer, but also the great unifier of the Jewish people. And he wanted everyone to be able to partake of that experience, not just, you know, in today's yeshiva world, there are 20,000 students in the United States of what we call post-high school, of Beis Medrash age and up, undergraduate and graduate, both in yeshivas. And there are 20,000 or so, which constitutes 1/3% of the Jewish population, if I'm not mistaken, in the United States. My grandfather's view was that that's not okay. And in his day, it was a far smaller percentage who had a connection to Torah, and there were far fewer Balabatim who had a connection. He wanted to bring Torah to the people, and he recognized that not everyone's going to come learn in yeshiva, and not every Balabas will have the opportunity to have spent time in yeshiva. So he thought to himself, how do I go ahead and bring Torah into the communities so that they're part and parcel of the communities, that everybody, young and old, can partake and can have that incredible connection to Torah that belongs to everybody. And that was the gestation. That was how the Kol movement was conceptualized. In my grandfather's day, it wasn't that popular in the major Jewish population centers. It was really in my father's day, Rav Schneur Zatzal, who he had this mission to bring Torah to every Jewish community in the form of Kol learning and real active learning for people young and old around the country and around the world.
Well, Rav Aaron, I personally learned in Kol. It was some of the happiest years of my life, and I think every marriage should start with the Kedusha of a house, you know, the sanctification of a house in Kol. But the question is, I meet so many Kol guys, they're in their 30s, they have 6 or 7 children, and they just don't know where to go. And at that point in their lives, they don't need $25,000 or $30,000. They don't need a $50,000 starting job. They need a real serious job. And those are the years that they would have to be going, let's say, for a degree or something. They can't afford it because they're in their 30s already with a family. So what do? And it's getting worse because we're in a knowledge-based economy. Today, if you're just, you know, you're a reseller, you're doing internet patching, you're competing with 1 billion Chinese. If you don't have really a strong knowledge set that took years to obtain, you're starting just way behind the eight ball. You can never catch up, and you're doomed to a life of poverty. What do you say to these people?
Yes. So just to maybe cite some current statistics, you know, we just completed our 2014 economic impact report that's produced by a company called Appleseed. They do that for many institutions in the state of New Jersey. They do it for the higher ed community. And they've documented so far 11,000 new jobs created in Lakewood, $5.5 billion of new ratables. So if one thinks that you come into Lakewood and everybody's in the Beis Medrash, that's true. But the people in Beis Medrash are Balabatim. They're Yeshivalite, and they're those whose identity are Yeshivalite. But some of them are working, and some of them are not. It depends on the individual person. Baruch Hashem, with the help of some really good Balabatim, there has developed a path, and this goes to the viability of Klal Yisrael of today, and you know, of the yeshiva world of today, is that there was a time when people looked at the yeshiva model and they said, well, what's going to be? And I used to hear this all the time, David. People would say to me, this is not viable. Everybody's sitting and learning, and they're going to support themselves. And we see as things developed with the tremendous siyata b'shmaya and with askanas of great balabatim, is that the variety of options available to talmidim. So if you take in your average year in Beis Medrash Gevaya, about 1,000 talmidim leave every year. which is a staggering number. And we're getting a little bit more than 1,000 every year. Obviously, we continue to grow, but there's a huge amount of Tomei Nemuhlis. Now, of that, we can break that out into a few general categories. There is one category of those who are perhaps returning to Eretz Yisrael or going to other institutions around other mosques and all. The majority of them break out as follows. We've got about 200 to 250 a year who go into Klal life. They are the your children's Rebbeim, the Roshi Mostis, the people who are staffing institutions around the world. And there are over 1,100 institutions today that are that were founded by or are led by Talmidei Beis Medrash Gabaya. And Baruch Hashem, 200 to 250 a year on average go out to do that. And there are hundreds that will join some of the PCS tracks, which, David, I know you've had a tremendous hand in, and so many thousands of families in Klal Yisrael owes you and the others a huge yashikayach for that. But there was a critical, beautiful path created for those who want to get a professional degree, be it in IT, be it in accounting, be it in nursing home administration, real estate, and a whole host of, and a growing host of career tracks that are available, which thousands of graduates of Beis Medrash Gabaya have taken advantage of. Then there are many who go into business, small businesses and large businesses alike. Just by way of example, there are 16 healthcare services companies that I know of in Lakewood who employ collectively well over 1,000 people. And there are about 30 Amazon resellers that I know, and companies in just about every industry that you can imagine, from trucking, freight forwarding, customs clearing, fleet management, all forms of IT, hardware, software, and on, and of course, the entire array of services and all. So the opportunities, going to yeshiva and spending years in Kailal, really opens one up to such a broad array of opportunities in life that it's not what people would have imagined. In the old days, everyone would say, this model of Torah and serious learning is not viable. Not only is it viable, it also succeeded both in a practical Olam Haza sense, but in doing that, keeping the Torah Kva for these Balabatim, which my grandfather would have said, that's the greatest success, is that one can be Osik and Torah his whole life and maintain those values in such a beautiful way and maintain that focus.
Rabaron, I'm on the board of many schools, many yeshivas, and a job recently opened up for a 10th grade. There were 200 applicants. So my question is, certainly there are many jobs that are filled by the great Beis Medrash Gavaya. There are many Rabbanim, you know, yeshivas, etc. But what are the 199 that are turned down? And I've seen this repeatedly where there's 100, 200, 300 applicants for a job, and the rest are sort of standard. Is it stranded? Is it still possible? I mean, is it realistic when we say, I want to get a job in chinuch today? Or is Rabban is given the immense amount of applicants for the very few jobs to get one?
I don't think that's representative. But what I do think is representative is the fact that, let's take a community like Lawrence, New York, where the W took a Lakewood Talmud, Rabbi Stern, and then Shari Tefila took a Lakewood NYU Talmud, Rav Ori Orleon. And also, let's go over to Teaneck now, to Englewood. They just took a younger man named Rabbi Mordechai Kassus to lead their Sephardic shul, which is in
a... So what happens to the other 199?
I don't think what the instance you're mentioning, I don't think it's representative, although if it's a really good job, there may be many who want. But what I do think it is representative of is that there is an aspiration for many to be Marbitze Torah. And if it's a great opportunity for Abbotza Satira, there will be many who want that, like in any coveted position. So I, not knowing the circumstances of that individual, Maisid, if it was a great opportunity for Abbotza Satira, there certainly would be a large number of candidates for it.
Rabaran, is it reasonable to assume that when people coming out of Kollel in their late 20s, 30s, or even later, that with a six-month course or a three-month course, they're going to compete with people who've had 10 to 15 years of schooling and experience and far smaller families and needs than them? I mean, are we being realistic here?
I'm involved in quite a few placements that come out of PCS, so I just had the good fortune to place one of the graduates in a career track for leadership at a hospital. So I see many of them, and if you look at the graduates, many of them are much there, but you are pointing to two very, very important points. One is, for a from Jew today, life is far more expensive than it is for many, many other people, and that's by virtue of our private school tuitions, by virtue of our Shabbos and Yontif, and by virtue of social needs, and of course, Kenina Harba sizes of our families. So life in America for a frum family, for every frum family, is expensive. What you're also highlighting is a very important second point, that every Yungaman who goes to yeshiva, everyone who learns in Kollel, may be making a sacrifice for Torah their entire life, because they might have given up those 2 or 3 years when maybe they would have made partner earlier in the accounting firm or in the law firm or wherever it is that they're going to. So that's a sacrifice that I wouldn't call it pas b'melech teichel, but it's certainly, in some modern-day version, the young man who says to himself, or the young woman who says, I'd like to start out my years of life in Kollel, or I'd like to learn 10, 15 years, or 20 years, they're making a tremendous sacrifice that sometimes will continue for their entire life. They view it as ennobling and as uplifting for all of Kollel Yisrael. But you are absolutely right, David. It's a sacrifice, and we should recognize it as such.
Rabaran, there are around 5,000 Kollel wives working in Lakewood for many companies. In fact, when we were in Lakewood and I was in Kollel, my wife used to travel into New York a few days a week. Does it concern you that mothers are not at home? I mean, isn't the history, besides called Kvudabas Balchpnima, but of the mother as sort of the Akeres Habayis, the Aim Habonim, the Akeres Habayis, the mother taking care of children, and more certainly in an age where we have the internet, the iPhone, so many kids going off the derech, isn't a mother's job to be at home raising her brood?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, in the Lakewood model, As myself, both as an employer of a few hundred people and also having been involved in startups that now employ maybe 400 or 500 people in all. So the Lakewood model is a very interesting one because the work day typically stops for the women at about 3 or 4 o'clock, and then they're home when the kids come home from school. And Erev Shabbos, Erev Yontif have different types of vacation schedules. So you have many, many companies in Lakewood, large employers, and I'm not just talking about the schools, obviously, which is pretty much a given that they'll follow that, but even many of the professional companies who are large employers. I know one company that has 80 people in their recovery and billing departments, and they end at about 3:30, and the mothers come home. And the Yungalite schedules, those who are learning in yeshiva, also kind of revolves around the children and the family and all. So The model has adapted itself very, very much to the needs of the parents to be with the children, and that sacred responsibility that the parents spend with that. So,
thank you very much. That's Harav HaGaon Rabaran Kotler, the CEO of Lakewood, New Jersey, Chief Executive Officer, the great Miyuchas, and the head of the largest yeshiva in the world. And we're going to go next to a different opinion. So let's bring on our next guest. We have with us on the phone Dr. Alan Kadish, who's the president and CEO of Touro College, which has made it its raison d'être of educating from a youth. Welcome, Dr. Kadish.
Thank you very much.
Could you give us briefly a synopsis? What is the mission statement of Touro?
Touro has dual interlocking missions. The first part of the mission is to preserve the Jewish community for the next generation. And a major part of it, as you kindly said, was to educate from students in a kosher environment, which is Shomer Shabbos, and on the undergraduate level, where men and women are completely separate, to educate them to be people who can earn a living, support their families, and grow as Torah Jews. That's the main part of Turo's historical mission.
So, Dr. Kadish, how would you respond to people who say, and there are many, that there's really no need for an education? I mean, you know, the Jewish community, Baruch Hashem, sprinkled with many successful people who have not gone to college, who some of them haven't finished high school, who live at their wits and are able to create businesses and employ many people and have created, you know, big family foundations, etc. Why do you need college?
First, it's a gift from Hashem that we have people who are talented enough to do that. And thank God there are people who are successful. But the issue is not about only individual stories. The issue is, what does the community as a whole need, and how can the community as a whole succeed? And as, thank God, family sizes increase, the frum population increases, the ability of a few fantastically successful balei tzedaka to support the entire community becomes diminished. If we look at the community on an aggregate level, putting everything together, both statistically and looking at individual stories, we see that these tremendous stories of success, which are fantastic and are wonderful tributes to Hashem and to the Jewish people, these individual stories of success don't represent the community at large.
So Dr. Kadish, I lived in Lakewood for over 17 years. And the community was full of people who left Kollel and established businesses and opened up stores. And there's healthcare providers and all kinds of nursing home operators. And it seems to be, so how would you respond to that?
First of all, there are individual stories of tremendous success. But when you look at the community as a whole, it's not reflected. For example, in some parts of Lakewood, the poverty level, based on accepted definitions, approaches 50%. So what does that mean on a practical level when we say poverty level?
Dr. Kadish, where are you getting your data from?
This is from the U.S. Census Bureau that publishes data about poverty level. So what's a poverty level? Poverty level for a family with four children means you're making less than $32,000 a year. $32,000 a year. For the entire family.
That's for six people, you mean?
That's for six people. For eight people, it's $40,000. We're talking about not a lot of money.
Talking about $5,000 a person a year to live on.
To buy food, to pay for housing, to pay for education.
Well, tuition is $3,000, so that you're left with $2,000 a year to live on? Is that what? What did you say? The data says 50% poverty in parts of Lakewood?
Close to 50% poverty in parts of Lakewood. In the front parts of Lakewood, in most of the front parts of Lakewood, the poverty levels are between 30 and 50%. And that means that you basically don't have enough money to live on. You're dependent on tzedaka. You're dependent on governmental assistance. And for a short period of time, thank God, that means that our kids are not starving absolutely in the street. But in terms of a long-term sustainable existence for the community, it's very difficult to see how that model can sustain the community in the long term, despite the few tremendous success stories. And it's gotten worse. So why has it gotten worse? It's gotten worse for three reasons. One is, as Lakewood was being built, there were individual opportunities for businesses, for people to start anew. And in many cases, some of those stores, services, they're there already. There's not as much opportunity. Secondly, family sizes, thank God, are increasing, which is a tremendous thing. But it means that you have more people who have to develop businesses that can be self-sustaining. And finally, on a national level, there's been a dramatic change if you look at employment. Right now, two-thirds of the new jobs that are available nationally, and again, there are individual exceptions, but two-thirds of the jobs that are available require a college education. That's vastly different than it was 20, 30 years ago, where the numbers needing a college education were below 50%. People talk about the unemployment rate in the United States. The reality is there are tons of jobs in the United States that go unfilled because we're not training people who are qualified to do those jobs. You have to have, for many jobs these days, to succeed, even in business, you have to have a relatively sophisticated understanding of math. You have to be able to read and write fluently, present and write briefs to engage customers, to succeed in business. And, of course, there are stories of individuals who are able to do that without a formal education, tremendous geniuses. But on a population level, it's not working. And a family that's below the poverty level can barely afford to feed itself.
So, Dr.
Maybe
Kate,
there's meat on Shabbos.
Oof. Do you see stories like that coming into Turo?
So I can tell you stories of two of our students who graduated from Turo who were getting along with great difficulty before they went to college and now have succeeded tremendously. So I'll tell you about two of them. Both of them are in Borough Park. Turo College has been educating the Frum community in Brooklyn for over 30 years. So our stories, particularly the long-term success stories, are from Brooklyn. So I'm going to tell you about a young woman and a young man, and obviously not use their real names. So the first one I'll call Racheli, who grew up as a Hasidic Jew in Borough Park and became a secretary after she graduated high school in 1982. She had six children, and her husband learned, and she realized that with six children as a secretary, it just wasn't possible to feed her family and make them comfortable. So she went to Turo. She went to law school. She has a practice right now in Monroe, and she's making close to 10 times what she was making as a secretary. And now her family has food. She can pay yeshiva tuition instead of depending on tzedakah. She can send her kids to camp so that they can have a summer. And she has tremendous hakaras hatov to Turo and tremendous hakaras hatov to Hashem for giving her this opportunity. The second one is a young man who I'll call David. So David grew up in Borough Park, is a chassid, had a wife and four children. He began as a teacher for disability students, which, using a degree that he obtained on an early level at Turo, and had planned to become a lawyer at some point. But he decided, based on the influence of our professors, to become an accountant. And in one of the few recent years, he won a prize for becoming the nation's top scorer on the CPA exam. Out of 10,000 people who took the test in his time and 91,000 who took it during the course of the year. And again, I don't want to say too much without revealing his name, but he has a tremendously successful job right now. And his wife and four children will be able to live in a way that befits a firm family. And
so Dr.
he's
Kadish,
looking to have more children.
Dr. Kadish, how would you... We recognize... I think you would recognize that Torah is the lifeblood of our people. How do we juxtapose the concept of kollel, which I personally believe every family should at least start off in kollel? I think it sets a fabulous foundation, a spiritual foundation for a marriage that's not rooted in materialism, and yet balance it with the education that you're suggesting, because... You know, when people come out of kollel, and I asked this question to Rabbi Cutler, I said, you know, they're often in their 30s and they have five kids or six kids. There's no time left for education. So how do you juggle these two seem competing, get educated, and yet learn?
So first of all, I agree with you completely. The level of learning in our community is phenomenal. It's fantastic. And neither Turo nor I want to do anything to reverse the fact that every person we learn who grows, every person we raise who grows up in a firm environment, who learns, will be a tremendous addition to Torah and mitzvos, to the idea of Limud Torah, and to their future lives. But the reality is, I don't believe either that kolel is permanent kolel is right for everyone, or that the community can sustain it. And I've spoken to Rosh Yeshiva at the largest yeshivas in the world, and the reality is they all recognize there will come a time when many of their talmidim will be ready to leave kolel, will have to leave kolel. So how do we balance it? I think there are two things that are prescriptions. One is, it's very hard to teach a 30-year-old basic math and reading and writing skills. I think that's something we have to incorporate with appropriate, quote, cultural sensitivity, as the non-frum term goes. But in a Torah environment, we have to teach kids the basic skills that they're going to need for the rest of their lives when they're younger. But if they have that foundation, Turo and other schools have creative programs where Ben Azmanim kids can learn, where kids can learn in online programs, where we can have accelerated programs for older people once they're finished with Kolel to allow them to get high-paying jobs. And it requires creativity. So for some kids, a bachelor's degree earned with some credits that they got part-time will work. With subsequent graduate school, as the CPA student I talked to you about, for other kids, perhaps a 9-month coding institute, which we've started in Flatbush, meaning that 9 months you take kids who've got a background in math, teach them computer skills so that they can get high-paying jobs with only 9 or 12 months of education, if they have the right background. Those kinds of creative programs can build an interface between the tremendous schar of Limud Torah, but also for those who can't spend their entire lives learning while they raise a family, giving them a pathway to economic success, to self-respect, to being able to themselves give tzedakah, and to support the next generation of our community. I think it's important that this be an option, not for everyone. There are those, thank God, who will spend their lives learning and their lives as clay kodesh. But I think it's important that the option of entering the workforce, a changing workforce where college education will be far more important than it was 10, 20, 30 years ago, the option of that ability to enter the workforce through a college education or through a higher level education has to be there for our community, for the community to sustain itself and survive. It's not going to work any other way, and Turo views that as its mission.
So, Dr. Kadish, have you had, what are the number of, let's say, Frumma students that you would say you currently have in your program?
We have about 2,800 Frum students in our program right now. We have tens of thousands of graduates. They come from a variety of backgrounds, but in the schools we have in Brooklyn, which come primarily from the yeshivish and Hasidic community, we have about 1,500 to 2,000 students each year. And those students are all educated in a Torah environment, in single-sex classes, in a chance to get and reach professional success.
And Dr. Kadish, if they want to continue within the Turo system, what postgraduates, like where could they continue? What degrees do you provide after basics? Like can they medicine, law, like what do you sustain? Say if you come to us and you do well, we will get you into graduate schools that give the following skill sets. Could you quickly list some of them?
Sure. We have schools in a variety of business disciplines. So we have an MBA in finance. We have a CPA, which now requires a master's level education in New York State. We have some tremendously successful actuaries who've gone through our program. We have a law school. We have a business school in other areas. We have graduate schools in every aspect of science and healthcare, including 5 medical schools.
Five medical schools? Any in the New York area?
There are 3 in the New York area, 1 in Westchester, New York Medical College, and then 2 osteopathic medical schools, 1 in Manhattan on 125th Street, and 1 in Middletown, New York, on the way to the Catskills.
Now, do you have nursing or psychology? Like, what are the skills?
We have 3 schools of nursing, 1 in Brooklyn, 1 in Manhattan, and actually 2 on the West Coast. We have 5 PA schools, including 3 in the New York area. We have schools of speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy. We have a pharmacy school, almost every imaginable healthcare degree that one could want. We're starting a dental school within the next year or so. So almost any healthcare degree that you could want is accessible to our students with preferred admission, and we do a great job preparing students for all those professions. We also have graduate schools of education. We have particularly good programs in social work, where we have Rabbanim and Chazanim who've gone through those programs and continue dual careers where they teach and they also serve as Klei Kodesh. So there's a tremendous variety of graduate programs that are available to our students. But we also have many students who succeed after their undergraduate degree with the increasing ability of our students to solve problems, to interact in the business world, to be able to do a quality presentation, to be able to write a quality business plan, both from an English standpoint and from a mathematical standpoint. And those are skills you need to succeed in an increasingly complex world. You can't exist without being computer savvy. You can't exist without understanding marketing. And those are skills we pass on to our students.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kadish, and keep up the mitzvah of, I imagine, the shalom bayis, the happy children, the mitzvah scharcha harbe miyai. Thank you very much for giving us your time and joining us this morning.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure, as always, to speak with you.
You're listening to Headlines, Contemporary Halachic Issues. You can listen to us Matzah Shabbos on WMCA 570 from 11 to 12. Or at WMCA.com or at NachumSiegel.com. Again, Matzah Shabbos from 11 p.m. to 12 a.m. On Monday morning from 11 a.m. to 12 noon at NachumSiegel.com. Or now on Wednesday evening from 9 to 10 on WSNR 620 a.m. That's WSNR 620 a.m. We have with us on the line the world-famous psychologist and probably the most renowned family counselor in America for the Frum community, Dr. David Pelkowitz. Welcome, Dr. Pelkowitz.
Hi, nice to talk to you again.
So, Dr. Pelkowitz, we had Rabbi Kotler from Lakewood, Rabbi Aaron Kotler, speak about the transcendent beauty of a Kol life and how it's the lifeblood of Klal Yisrael. And then he said, but it's, you know, what happens after Kol can be difficult, and he said there's a sacrifice to the couples afterwards. As a family counselor who's been doing this for probably 30 years, not that I want to age you, Chas v'Shalom, can you tell us in your experience how do people deal with these financial stresses that follow Kollel?
Okay, right. So it very much varies with the person because the impact of financial challenges is very complex. It depends on the personality of the family members. It depends on whether or not they're surrounded by other people who have a lot more than they have. But if I could speak in a more general way, what the research on the impact, let's say, on children and adolescents of growing up in a family where there just isn't enough money to go around, the global way, it finds that the way it might impact on kids is, number one, is that when there's not enough money, parents get stressed out. They're much more likely to be stressed. And when parents have a high level of stress, it could show itself in parenting with a lot of yelling, screaming, and criticism, tendency sometimes to be punitive and harsh and unresponsive. And that, in turn, can have profound impact on children. And in general, financial challenges are associated with even impact on whether or not you reach your cognitive potential. It could put children and adolescents at higher risk for depression and behavioral difficulties. Again, that's in a general way. There may very well be, I'll talk about the ingredients of resilience in a few minutes, but it is something to think about. Now, in addition to it impacting on parenting, financial pressures can really very much impact on marriages. So, for example, in study after study, we note that the way couples fight about money is different than the way they fight about other things. So we know that when there's fighting about money, those fights are more likely to kind of pervade the marriage. They're more likely to be recurrent. They happen over and over again. And they're not likely to be resolved the same way other conflicts could be resolved. And because of that, there's a higher rate of depression, anger outbursts, a tendency to avoid dealing with some of the hurt related to that. What is it that it says in the Sefer HaSidim? Achris ketata charata. After argument, there's regret. But when you have families who are really struggling to have enough money to go around for everything from food to adequate housing to, to being able to buy, even basic needs for their children, even with tzedakah and with all the wonderful chesed and gemachs that are in the community, it can take a toll. Now, does that mean it has to happen? Absolutely not. You know, the research also shows that in some families, when the family, in spite of financial challenges, is able to transcend the stress and work together. So when the couple, instead of fighting, they just present a united front to the children and they work together as a couple and they figure out a way to, in spite of the financial challenges, to throw themselves into learning and community and meaning, then there is no evidence that it has to be associated with bad things. It's just that the deck is stacked against you when you have these challenges, and it often comes as a real rude awakening to certain people when they are comparing themselves to those who don't have that. Can I share a story with you?
Yes, certainly.
Yeah, it's more of a general story, but it's what I think might be one of the main points here. It's about something called the principle of relative deprivation, that what's hardest about being challenged financially and living even in poverty is not so much the objective lack of stuff or lack of money to buy things as your feeling that others have it and others don't. So there's a wonderful story shared by Robert Frank. Robert Frank is a well-known economist and a pretty wealthy guy. And he talks about being very idealistic. When he gets out of college, he volunteers for the Peace Corps, where he volunteers to give 2 years of his life to help poor people in different parts of the world. So they assign him to Nepal. And his plane lands in Nepal, and he's picked up, and they take him on a 12-hour drive to the middle of the country. They drop him off. They say, we're going to pick you up in 2 years. Your job is to teach the kids here in this very, very impoverished part of the world. So the first thing he sees is that they have him assigned to live in a one-room hut with no running water and no electricity. So he's in a state of total yeesh. You know, how could I survive? I come from a comfortable background, and here I'm living in poverty with a one-room hut, no water, no electricity. But he says what was amazing is it took him not even 2-3 days to get completely used to it. Why? Because everybody around him also had a one-room hut with no running water and no electricity. But here's where the story gets interesting. He gets his first paycheck, and the paycheck was for $40 for the month. And again, now he says, you know what, I have to go home. I'm not going to be able to live on $40 a month. But then he discovers that nobody in that part of Nepal is making any more than $30 a month. So he's making $10 more a month than anybody else in the neighborhood. And he goes on to say that he never felt wealthier or happier in his life than he did living on $40 a month in a one-room hut with no water and no electricity. Why am I sharing that story? Because I think that's an important part of what goes into this mix. You could have people who come out of their years of learning in Kolo with tremendous purpose and tremendous love and happiness and meaning in their life because of learning, but the rude awakening then of living with not enough money to go around, living with the tremendous expenses of sending kids to yeshiva and housing and large families. All those are very much dependent on the ability to live for yourself and turn inward and work together. But those who can't, those who compare themselves to have more, are at risk for the problems that I was talking about.
Now, has, Dr. Polkowitz, has there been any studies done as to the happiness of the families who've gone through the Kollel system, like, you know, 5 or 10 years later, vis-a-vis your average family that didn't?
Yeah, so I'm not familiar. No, there's a lot of research on, in general, what it's like to live with less than others, what it's like to live in poverty, all that kind of, you know, all those kind of studies. They're literally hundreds. But unfortunately, we don't really have much in the way of empirical research that I'm familiar with. Any of your listeners are familiar with, you know, any studies done specifically, you know, like empirical studies looking at it. All I know is what we know from an impressionistic standpoint. Some families thrive, and other families really do have a hard time. We know that there's a fairly high rate of depression in these families. Sometimes the men and the women in these families start to feel worn down, and they start to feel stressed out. But there are others who don't at all. It's very much associated with so many factors that have to do with personality style, maybe risk for depression, and maybe most importantly, how good the marriage is and how good they are at keeping their stress at a level that's manageable for them. We do have to have that kind of research. We really do.
Well, Dr. Polkowitz, if you ever want to do the research, we'd be very interested in joining you and sponsoring it. Thank you very much for your time, and we appreciate your insights, and keep up all the incredible mitzvahs and ma'asim tovim that you do.
And thank you. You too. Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us, and I'd like to thank our amazing guests, Rabbi Goldwicht, Rabbi Aaron Cutler, Dr. Alan Kadish, Dr. Polkowitz. Next week, again, we're going to have some really, again, fabulous guests. We will have Rabbi Simcha Scala from High Lifeline, and we will have the Ravid, the Rav Av Bezdin of the Eidach Redis of Yerushalayim, Harav HaGoyin, Tzadik, Harav Moshe Sternbuch, the Baal of the Mayadim and Uzmanim. I look forward to speaking to you and hearing from you next week. If you have any questions, send it to us at questions@headlinesbook.com. You're listening to us on WMCA 570, WMCA.com, or NachumSiegel.com, or Monday morning at Nachum Siegel at 11 a.m. or on WSNR 620 at 10 p.m. on Wednesday night. Thank you so much.